Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another interview that we have here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed and YouTube channel. I have a very special guest for y'all tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce our guest. He is a national NBA writer for the Washington Post. He's a co-host of the Greatest of All Talk podcast and the author of Bubble Ball. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Golliver. Ben, how are we doing today, man?
I'm good. How long has it been, man? I feel like it's been a minute since we chatted.
Yeah, so it's crazy because, Ben, you know, you've interviewed me back when I was far from like really having a credible guest. I was like recording in a garage in Bangor, Washington, and I've since been picked up with No Ceilings and been covering the draft. And I've been wanting to work with you for a while, so I'm glad we finally got time. But I just want to first off thank you, man, for just being one of the guests that continued to like spur me on and continue to chase my dreams of covering basketball.
Well, I'm glad to do it. Glad to see your success, and nothing against garage podcasts, man. You know, it's it's all part of the game, right? You know, I'm here in a little office right now, but I can't tell you all the places I've recorded shows from over the years. So, you know, it's getting real down bad if you're doing it in like the back of a car. You got to crack the window down a little bit, you know, so you don't overheat. It's all in the game, though, man. It's all in the game.
That's right. I mean, some of the most successful people start in a garage, right? I think like Apple and Nirvana, right? Like all those, a lot of successful people start in the garage. But Ben, I want to thank you for your time, man. I know you cover the NBA, and part of the NBA is the draft, and we haven't had a chance to talk about this yet, but this draft has been discussed as being bad or flat, things of that nature. It hurts my feelings because I love covering the draft no matter who's in it, right? But what were your thoughts about the draft coming into this past week?
You can't let feelings come into it, right? You just got to be honest. I mean, I think that when you're coming off a year with Wembanyama as the number one pick, everyone's going to look bad by comparison, right? And it's an interesting sandwich because you have Cooper Flagg coming next year. I got a chance to see him maybe in March or April. He was playing at that Hoop Summit tournament, and man, he had all the A-list executives out there in Lake Oswego, Oregon, taking in the practices at the Hoop Summit, watching him and see what he can do. So it just kind of feels like, well, look, you're not going to have three amazing number one prospects in a row year after year after year. You're bound to have a down year. This one felt especially down because, you know, the top prospects came from different places, right? Like you got a French kid, you got the other French kid who's playing in Australia. You know, obviously you've got some G League Ignite guys whose careers there did not go very well. They probably could have been in the mix maybe for number one, had that program been in a better place this past season at times. I think those guys were ranked pretty close to the top of the draft boards, both Ron Holland and Bouzelis at various points. And then you just had a weird college year where like all the one and done freshmen were just horrible in the tournament. So, you know, I remember doing like a tournament preview guide. It's like, yeah, you know, check out Cody Williams or check out the Kentucky guards. Like this is going to be incredible. And these guys pretty much all lost early, and they all scored like 2 points a game. So you're sitting there saying, like, well, what were you supposed to watch? You know, like there wasn't really a lot for the casual fan to tune in. So I think it was fairly maligned as an unpredictable class. I think there's some interesting fits in that top five in terms of which direction teams went. And you know somebody's good is going to come out of it. Even the worst drafts produce, you know, perennial all-stars. So it winds up being a test of who really has the best eye among the NBA executives, right? Who can find that diamond in the rough?
Yeah, and that's something that we've been kind of putting out amongst the draft community is like there's talent to be had no matter how the top of the draft looks, even though that there's not someone standing on top of the mountain waving their hand saying, hi, I'm the future of the NBA right here, right? There's going to be someone good who comes out of this. So Atlanta thinks that Zachary Risacher is the best bet for their team, right? I mean, we just saw that they selected him number one overall after vaulting up the draft lottery. I mean, it seemed like it really kind of shook up their strategy on who they wanted to look at. Now, again, a lot of us in the draft community would be like, how are you not looking at the top prospects that are being discussed within this class? But they weren't really in a position that where they should have believed that they would have been taking a player in the top three. But here we are, right? And we know since the draft, they've moved off of Dejounte Murray and AJ Griffin. They ended up taking Zachary Risacher number one. Was that what you kind of expected, or were you more surprised by that selection?
Well, it's tricky because typically in a bad draft, you would use the number one pick on the guy with the highest ceiling. That's usually kind of what happens. And you just kind of cross your fingers and pray, right? And I think almost everybody agreed Alex Saar was the guy who had the highest ceiling. Alex Saar never worked out for the Atlanta Hawks. And in fact, it sounds like he didn't really work out for anyone besides the Washington Wizards, who drafted him at number two. I think for a lot of draft dorks who might be watching this show, they realize like that's a very famous thing that the Oklahoma City Thunder like to do, which is work a player out, especially an international player, decide they want to take him, and then try to get him to shut down the workout so that he will land. You know, they'll kind of steer the player towards themselves, right? Well, the Washington Wizards' new president, Michael Winger, is a former Thunder executive, so it's possible he took a similar strategy with Saar, and it kind of forces Atlanta to make a tough decision, right? It's like, well, do you take the guy with the highest ceiling? In this case, you know, Saar plays the same position as Okongwu, and they have Clint Capella, who's kind of a veteran. I feel like he's pretty much, you know, he's on his last legs, I think, as a big time, you know, impact making type of player in the NBA.
Sure.
But it wasn't really a position of need, you know, center with Saar. And I think they wound up taking the safe choice, right? Like, they didn't want to get into a staring match with Saar. They kind of blinked at it probably in the stare down and just decided, well, Reese Achay will fit. He's a shooter. He spaces. He'll probably be pretty good. I don't know if he's going to be great. And I think it's going to be a slow ramp up for him. You know, I think just, you know, seeing how he conducted himself during NBA draft week, he just came across as very young, a little bit timid, getting used to the NBA environment. He looked great on draft night, looked a little bit more confident when he was in the suit and having a good time during that celebration. But he has a big target on his back now. And I think the fact that they went for the safe pick, it informs what you were talking about with those trades. The Hawks don't know who they are. They just want someone who will kind of fit with any version of the team that they become. They trade out DeJounte Murray. That breaks up their core. Now people are going to wonder, is Trae Young next? If so, you at least know Reese Achay is going to be a shooter who can kind of fit in with whatever your backcourt looks like in the future. And, you know, hoping that potentially one day he can kind of develop into an all-star level scorer. We'll see. I wasn't huge on him. I think if I had been in their spot, I would have been really tempted to just take Saar and cross my fingers and pray that he could become, you know, that defensive anchor, the Jaren Jackson Jr. type, the Evan Mobley type of guy. And obviously they went a different direction.
I agree with you that if I was in that spot, that's who I would have taken. I also kind of wonder that, like, maybe Landry Fields and Kyle Korver, the people who are helping make that decisions, maybe they are just more comfortable scouting wings. You know, that might be something that could have played a factor in there. But after the first pick, Ben, we saw, you know, obviously Zachary Richey, Alex Saar went second, Reed Sheppard goes three, Steph Castle goes four. This is where the draft really started for a lot of people, right? Because there was rumors that Matas Buzelis was climbing up the boards. He has agency ties to the Detroit Pistons. There's a lot of smoke that he was going to be the pick there. Lo and behold, his teammate from the Ignite ends up going fifth overall in Ron Holland. Was anyone hearing anything that Ron was going to be the Pistons guy? Because just from someone who, you know, doesn't have as many NBA sources as, like, say, you've been, it just took me by surprise. Was that, like, the general feeling that you had as well?
Yeah, I think that was one of the first big surprises of the night, probably the biggest surprise of the night early, because no one knew what the new GM there, Trajan Lankin, was going to be looking for, right? I think everybody realized Pistons need shooting, right? And that's why they go and make a trade for a Tim Hardaway Jr., right? Like, that's what's been kind of – they've even been linked to, like, Zach LaVine in past trade rumors because they need shooting so badly. And so you figured that's what they would look at with their, you know, number five pick. You look at Ron Holland, shoot the ball terrible for the G League Ignite. He's not known as a shooter. He's known as a big physical wing, a guy who projects as, like, a two-way wing where he can maybe defend the other team's best player at some point of his, you know, down the road in his career, and maybe be a scorer off the dribble a little bit and do those kinds of things, but not a knockdown shooter. And so you start to look and say, well, you took Asar Thompson last year, you take Ron Holland this year. I mean, Cade Cunningham's going to be playing in a box again, you know, for like the fourth straight season there at Detroit. It's just you feel for the guys. So it was a little bit strange because they have this entire regime change, and the new regime comes to the same conclusion as the old one, which is let's just draft the best athlete on the wing and hope we can figure out how the shooting thing works. That strategy has not worked for Detroit in the past, and I'm not sure it's going to work here for them either. I think if you're a Pistons fan, though, you can console yourself with the fact Holland at one point was viewed as like the best player in his high school class. He does have the physical makeup that not a lot of these guys do. Like, he's one of those guys kind of man among boys, I think, with this class. You know, there's so many guys, whether it's Buzelis or a Reed Sheppard, who just, they look their age, you know, they look like they're 19. Yeah. I think Holland may be a little bit further down the developmental track from that standpoint, but I'm not sure that's a reason why you drafted number five. You know, I was kind of scratching my head with that pick, but I've been saying that for almost every move the Pistons have made here over the last 4 years. So,
sure.
You know, maybe sometimes the wisdom of the crowds, you know, where everybody's like, what are they doing with this pick? You know, sometimes you trust that over the guys who are actually making it.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, bringing in Fred Vincent, who has New Orleans Pelican ties with new GM Trajan Langdon as well. He's going to have his work cut out for him. I'm sure that he's going to be eager to earn that nice paycheck that he's drawing there. But Ben, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back to continue on the show. Just hang tight. All right, we're back here with Ben Golliver of the Washington Post and the Greatest of All Talk podcast. Ben, it was rumored by a friend of the show, Kristen Peek, just phenomenal reporter and eye for talent as well, that TJ Salon was drawing a lot of interest from Charlotte. The size and the motor had a lot of people intrigued. Probably the French success of Victor Wembanyama had a little bit to do with it, the two by some who might not be as plugged into the scouting process. Did that move sort of forecast for you the direction that Charlotte is wanting to take? Because, I mean, they have Ball, they have Brandon Miller. There was a whole bunch of different ways they could have gone, but I think this kind of signals that there's still a long-term view with this team. What did you think of that move?
Well, first of all, I wasn't surprised that he went six. He was the guy a lot of people had mocked outside the top 10, and I went through my mock draft process. I think I put him at seven, maybe. I can't remember exactly, but my thought was, come on. I mean, this is the year to swing big, swing for the fences. I mean, if you're not totally sure who the best players are currently, well, then take the project because maybe that guy turns out to be the best of all of them. That was the kind of logic, obviously, that, you know, Milwaukee used with Giannis, right, years and years ago. And we definitely don't want to compare this kid to Giannis. I don't think anybody's doing that. But there's some nice physical tools, good size. Seems pretty fluid. Like, why not take him at six, especially if you're a Charlotte team, as you've correctly identified, is just, you know, a long way away. I mean, what they say about Bruno Caboclo, 2 years away from being 2 years away, it feels like with Charlotte, it's like 5 years away from being 5 years away. And I think the important context is they changed ownership groups last summer, but they didn't immediately clear house, right? So they kind of took their time. Let's figure out what we want to do with the front office. Let's figure out what we want to do with the coach. The new owners finally hired their own coach, Charles Lee. He's a rookie head coach. Now, he's been a longtime assistant in the NBA, very well regarded. And he's, you know, been an assistant at some winning programs, Milwaukee and Boston. So that's going to get, you know, people excited during the interview process. It feels like, you know, they're in good hands. But when you have a rookie head coach, when you've got a new ownership group, when you've got a franchise that hasn't been good in forever, and you had the number two pick last year who looks like your franchise building block, you're definitely in a long-term rebuilding mode. And I think the biggest question here is LaMelo going to be around for the end of it, right? Or did they reset their timeline sort of after LaMelo and maybe they wind up looking to make a move with LaMelo? I'm not saying instantly, but at some point he's going to want to win. He's already spent a lot of time there. He's had a lot of bad injury luck. But if they're bringing in these 18-year-olds that are going to need multiple years of development, if they're taking a by-the-ground-up rebuilding approach, at some point you wonder, is LaMelo's patience going to be there? Or do they just view him as maybe like a trade asset down the road? So that's something to keep an eye on with Charlotte. Beyond that, there's like nothing to watch with Charlotte this season. Just check back in 2 years. It'll be fine.
Yeah, for sure. And it's refreshing, though, to see teams take this long-term approach because, I mean – we're kind of wondering what Chicago's doing right now. Some of these trades that Atlanta has made is kind of questionable. So we always root for the teams that want to do it. I just hope that people are patient and that they're finally getting what they're wanting with this Charlotte team. So,
well, real quick, I mean, one point to build on that would just be that, you know, we have this new cap environment this summer. And so what you're going to see is a flattening of talent. The very expensive rosters are going to have to shed players. The cheaper rosters are going to have an opportunity to use their cap space to import talent or to use their flexibility to maybe bring on draft picks by like trading for a Reggie Jackson, which I believe Charlotte did that, right? Didn't they take Reggie Jackson's contract from Denver and get 3 second-round picks out of it? So this is a great time to have the long-term view, which is what you're talking about. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you could confuse it. Some ownership groups are like, oh, yeah, we're taking a long-term approach. Really, they're just being cheap. But I think you're right. I think Charlotte's sort of looking at the market and saying, our best bet here is to try to be good in 3 to 4 years. And if we play this right, if we keep our cap flexibility, if we don't overspend on anybody crazy, if we try to develop some of these young players, we could be in the mix down the road to really have a shot to be a playoff team and to sustain some success. And that's why you hire that rookie coach. And that's why you, you know, you draft the young kid.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great signals for the intentions of the future of that team for sure. So Ben, one of the most shocking moves of the night came when Minnesota traded up to the number 8 pick. This took me by surprise, right? Because San Antonio is building around Wimby. They have 2 lottery picks, albeit in a flat or a bad draft. They kick that can down the road a little bit more. Now I'm hearing that this is because this will be around the time Victor Wembanyama is in his prime. These picks that are coming later, they might help sustain that. They're not in a rush to kind of like outdo where they could be picking in next year's draft, like how you're saying. But Minnesota, in the meantime, they are in the process of trying to build a sustainable Western Conference contender, right? We just saw what they did this past year. Mike Conley is the veteran point guard, not getting any younger. With the move that Minnesota made, I mean, they traded first-round pick, and then they get Rob Dillingham out of Kentucky, who played second fiddle to Reed Shepard. What did you think about this move from both ends here, Ben? Because I think that this might be one of the rare win-win trades that we ever see in the NBA. Like, how do you feel about it?
Well, first of all, I'm really annoyed that the Spurs just didn't take Donovan Clingan at number 4. I wanted the Twin Towers duo. I wanted the best shot blocker in the NBA and the best shot blocker in the NCAA, combining forces to just let nobody score from inside 8 feet to give San Antonio that incredible defensive identity and to run this thing forward. That's what I wanted to see. So I was already bummed out by San Antonio's strategy before they even got to the fact that they traded the number 8 pick. Okay. And so knock on Castle. I like Castle. But man, sure, I wanted to see that Twin Towers.
They could have done that and then taken Zach Edey with the number 8 pick. That's a lot of humanity right there. Like, that would have been fun to watch.
Yeah, I just love this idea, though, because like, Clingan is such a good defensive player, right? And Wembanyama, everybody focuses on his amazing offense, and he is amazing on offense.
Sure.
His defense, I mean, he was almost a defensive player of the year as a rookie. He's probably going to be a defensive player of the year next year. And I think his defense is going to be their core strength. So I love when you're building around a player to try to find players who enhance his core strength. And that's why I really love the idea of them going big. Of course, they didn't do it. In terms of the timeline from San Antonio, it reminds me, like, if you ever try to save up for a car, you got to put away a little bit of money every single month, right? If the Spurs ever want to trade for a co-star for Wemby, we just saw what Mikal Bridges, who's not even a top 25 player, went for. It was like 5 or 6 picks, right? So if you're San Antonio, you better start saving now, right? Because if Wemby is really ready to compete for a title, like let's say in 3 years, well, you might need to have 8 first-round picks. Who knows? You know, just sitting around ready to kind of throw into a package to really get a big-time player. So that's what this move felt like to me. It kind of felt like, well, we got the guy we wanted at 4. We didn't love anybody enough at 8. Let's kind of roll those assets forward. And instead of trying to pick in 2030 or whenever that pick is supposed to convey, try to take that asset and trade it to somebody else to get a really big time player, maybe 2 or 3 years from now. It's hard to remain patient with Wemby because I think after year one, he's where a lot of Hall of Fame players are at, like after year 3. So he's that far ahead of schedule to me. So at some point here, they got to really be adding talent. I hope they do during the summer. I hope they can find some free agency, a point guard, a lead ball handler, a game manager type guy, either in free agency or trades. For Minnesota, it was a more simple phenomenon. They needed more bucket getters, as we saw in the playoffs. You know, Anthony Edwards, it was devolving to just too much one-on-one from him. When Karl-Anthony Towns wasn't making his shots, the offense really ground down in that Western Conference Finals. Mike Conley's getting a little bit long in the tooth. It just made sense kind of from a timeline standpoint. They have so many older players on that roster. You know, you want to have somebody who can kind of grow with Anthony Edwards, and you want to have a guy who can kind of plug in and get you offense when you need it, you know, down the road. I look at Dillingham more like a sixth man as opposed to a starter, but I think it was a, you know, it was a fun move for sure from the Timberwolves standpoint. It's going to get their fans excited. And what I love about Tim Connelly, their GM, I think he approaches the jobs like guys like you and I would. If he has a pick, he's going to trade it. I mean, this guy has traded like 10 years worth of picks. He's trying to swing for the fences. He's trying to build a winner. And, you know, if it blows up in his face, well, he'd probably go get a job somewhere else because he's done a really nice job of building winners in both Denver and Minnesota, right? So that guy is not out there trying to sit on picks 10 years from now and play it like Sam Presti. He wants to win now. And I think, you know, most, you know, fans and media members who follow this stuff closely, like, we do the same thing that Connolly does, right? Like, oh, yeah, get Dillingham. Oh, he's fun to watch. He's got a great handle. Yeah, we're trading for him. Who cares if we lose to our picks 8 years from now? Whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not, you know, most GMs have the mindset of, if I'm not going to be here to see it, then what's the point of it being there anyway, right?
So right.
There's that thought process. But, Ben, that wasn't the only trade that caught a lot of people off guard. Even coming into the draft, we had a big trade between the Portland Trailblazers and the Washington Wizards, where we saw the Wizards ship off Denny Avdia. In exchange, the Wizards would receive Malcolm Brogdon, the 14th pick, who they used to select Bub Carrington, a 2029 pick, and there's a lot of, you know, machinations that could be had out of that. And then 2 second-rounders. This move is looking like a win-win, kind of in the eyes of many, but what did you think about that? Because I think some people are saying it's like too much for Denny Avdia, but some people really like him.
Denny Avdia is a fine player. I did think it was a lot to give up for him. I mean, the thing with Denny is he's a winning player who's never been on a winning team, right? Like,
sure.
He's just been stuck there in Washington. So there's a hope you bring him in or you just move him somewhere else and all of a sudden he can really show his value. The problem is, I mean, Portland's not going to be a winning environment next year. So Denny in Portland could look an awful lot like Denny in Washington. And I think the real hangup for him is he's not a great shooter, right? And so if you've got these do-everything wings who aren't great three-point shooters, and I know he improved a little bit, but he's not like a knockdown, you know, 3-and-D wing. You know, those guys just aren't really that valuable as commodities in the NBA. The way I explain this trade is I think Portland got sick of losing. They got sick of the rebuild. They lost their patience with it. It's been pretty ugly there the last couple of years, and obviously the Damian Lillard thing hung over everything, but you know, they draft Klingon, who's obviously the most NBA ready guy available at 7, and they trade for Denny, who's a plug and play guy who's going to give you some quality minutes. It just seems to me like they said, look, we cannot do another 22 win season, even if we win 30, right? Or even if we can kind of like try to be 12th place instead of 14th place, like we need to make this move. And it doesn't feel like a great strategy or a great long-term plan from the Blazers. You know, there's not a huge ceiling to that. You know, not trying to make a joke with the name of your show, but the Blazers, they could be sponsored by you. Maybe you could be sponsored by them. I don't know how it would work. So much of what Portland's trying to do to me at this point still hinges on Scoot Henderson. Like, he has to break out and be something closer to a star in year two for any of this stuff to make sense. Otherwise, they've just collected all these random role players. Even DeAndre Ayton looks like a role player in Portland. He doesn't look like a number one option. He doesn't look like a guy you can really run a lot of offense through because the backcourt hasn't been good enough. And the main guy they drafted number 3 overall last year hasn't lived up to that billing yet. So it's a precarious place to be. At the same time, you want to get him some help. So, you know, it's not a horrible move for Portland, but I do just kind of question, like, where is it leading?
And I think that that's a fair question because, like you said, Avdia is like starting to hit his prime, going to a team that has a lot of, you know, higher ceiling players, but have not yet actualized that potential. So we'll see what happens down the line. But I'm interested to see what Washington looks like out of this because I'm a big Bub Carrington guy. I think that he could really ingratiate himself into that fan base in Washington there. But Ben, we're going to take our last break and then we'll get into the last few questions. So sit tight. All right, we're back here again with Ben Golliver of the Washington Post and the Greatest of All Talk podcast. Ben, Zach Edey, one of the most decorated collegiate athletes of all time, winner of consecutive Player of the Year awards. Memphis takes him with the 9th overall pick in a move that was, some people really liked it, some people are a little bit more skeptical, but we've seen the Grizzlies have success with the Steven Adams type player in the past. I'm going to ask you 2 questions. Did you like this move? And what do you think about Zach Edey as a player in today's NBA?
Well, this was the year to draft Zach Edey 8, right? Because, like, we know his stock was nowhere near this high last year. And in the past, there's been a lot of questions. Is he even going to be an NBA player whatsoever? the Grizzlies found themselves in a horrible spot thanks to Ja Morant. Ja Morant completely blew their window at having a super deep roster that was able to go, make playoff runs because they had so many guys on rookie contracts who were outperforming those deals, who were big impact players early. And unfortunately, Ja lost 1 year to that gun suspension, right? Blew up their playoff run. And then he lost the following year to the gun suspension and then the shoulder injury. So their window to really capitalize on their youth and their cost-controlled contracts completely flew by. And that's why they wound up having to trade Adams. They had to trade Xavier Tillman at the deadline. They had to kind of blow everything up because the big contracts have now kicked in for Ja, for Desmond Bane, and for Jaren Jackson. And so they're in a situation where they basically have three max players, and it's going to be all cheap people around the edges for that core from here going forward. So I know people have kind of forgotten about Ja because it's been so long since he's been on the court. Yeah. I'm one of his biggest fans in terms of being a player, you know, before all these incidents. He cost them so big in terms of what their entire blueprint was. And it could take them years to recover. So I look at Zach Edey, it's kind of like a Hail Mary. It's like, look, he's not going to be Steven Adams, especially defensively. I mean, he's not going to be that good. He could have some problems, you know, pace-wise, keeping up with Ja, his athleticism, how he wants to play. But Taylor Jenkins is a very smart coach. He's done a nice job of taking players who aren't completely fully fleshed out players and putting them in situations to be successful. Look at young Jaren Jackson Jr. He could barely stay on the court because of foul trouble, right? He was still working on trying to expand his range as a shooter. Well, he's developed into an all-star and a defensive player of the year candidate. He still has foul trouble. He's still a little bit streaky on offense, but they've done a nice job of bringing him along. Now, Edey's older. He's not going to need quite as much work as that. But I think if Edey's ever going to find a place to work, it's in a spot like Memphis, which knows how to deploy its talent. I think the big trick is, you know, you want to have the two big lineup look alongside Jaren because you don't want him to just have to play center all the time. That's a lot of pounding on his body. But ultimately, when you get to the playoffs, I really have a hard time seeing Edey being a part of their main groups. I think they're going to shift more to small ball in those situations, have Jaren at the five. And it's going to be more of a situational thing for Edey. So, you know, you never want to write a guy off, but are we going to look back on that championship game and say that was probably like the high moment of his career in terms of how much attention he got, the fact that he got Purdue there and everything? I think there's a really good chance that's how it plays out.
Yeah, and again, there's so many people who feel differently. Again, friend of the program, Kristen Pete, took to social media and said it was one of the biggest draft mistakes in NBA draft history, and that's in a flat draft, but there are some really smart people out there, Ben, that believe because he didn't just grow up traditionally like this lumbering big man, that he grew up playing, you know, more nimble athletic sports before taking to basketball. And just watching him and thinking about, okay, how college basketball posts him up and the NBA is be more pick and roll action, maybe he can do more than what we're seeing. I was more on the, I have had him in my early 20s on my personal board. Obviously, there's some level of talent, some level of like he's an outlier to some
capacity.
Well,
let me ask you this. Yeah. So if he's a terrible pick at 8, who's the player who was drafted pretty quickly after him who we're going to circle and say, oh my God, that player could have gone to Memphis. Memphis would be unbelievable if they had that guy. Is there anyone in that mix for you? Because part of the reason why I thought it was like a justifiable risk is because like, well, Klingon's already off the board. If they took Edey over Klingon, I'd be like, you guys are insane, right? Like, if you want the next Steven Adams, take Klingon. But Klingon's gone, and I understand not wanting to trade up to go get him because, you know, now you're kind of doing that in a bad draft. Maybe it doesn't make sense. Is there someone who can make Memphis, really eat their words on this one or kind of regret this move, do you think?
Well, I think if you're looking positionally, I think that there was such a far chasm after Donovan Klingon, in my opinion, where you started getting into Zach Edey, Khalil Ware, maybe Daron Holmes the second. There were a few of those bigs, but I mean, if you're looking outside of that position, one of the biggest falls of that night, Ben, was Dalton Connect. I mean, he fell to Los Angeles Lakers at 17. Obviously an older prospect, but he had kind of a unique trajectory, you know, where he grew up, where he kind of played in some of these, you know, D1 or D2 level schools, transfers up, plays to Tennessee, wants to get better defensively and show that he can succeed. He was the SEC Player of the Year. And I talked to John Fanta of Fox Sports, and he said that if it wasn't for Zach Edey, that Dont Connect could have been college basketball's player of the year. He did that good. The Lakers, who are now coached by J.J. Redick, might be one of the more unique minds to properly utilize him. And we saw that L.A. was pretty fired up to get him. Do you think that he'll have a chance to crack the Lakers rotation early, Ben, given, you know, the fact that he's older and that, frankly, Los Angeles kind of needs him?
Yeah, absolutely. He's going to get some opportunities. I mean, they've been desperate for shooting these last couple of years, and obviously that's what he's bringing to the table. I think the fact that he is 23 is what kept him out of the lottery. That's why he was one of those fallers. I went back and looked, and like the last 10 years, I think there's only four or five guys, like Denzel Valentine, a couple other guys, who were 23-year-old rookies taken in the lottery. So it's just really hard to do. And I thought, yeah, you know, Connect was going to be one of those guys this year just because it was a soft draft. But you saw the late lottery teams decide, you know what, I would actually rather take a risk on a Cody Williams. I'd rather wait a year on a Topic, right? And those are justifiable decisions to me. I think it makes a lot of sense. I saw some people comparing the idea of like the Lakers bringing in Connect was sort of like Miami with Jaime Jaquez last year, where you just have a guy who knows how to hoop and you can throw him out there and it's going to work out. So I do think he's going to get some opportunities. You know, there's been a lot of talk here in LA though, like JJ Redick is saying, we got to like get the ball out of LeBron's hand more often and, you know, really emphasize Anthony Davis offensively and try to find new ways to utilize LeBron. Give me a freaking break. We've been hearing about that LeBron for years and years and years. Guess yep. what's going to happen on night one of the season? The ball is going to be in LeBron's hands. And they're probably going to tell us they're going to try to limit his minutes too. That'll last for a week and a half, just like it did last year. He's going to be out back out there playing heavy minutes because that's how LeBron does it. So I think if I am Dont Connect, I'm spending all summer. I mean, starting today, working on catch and shoot three-pointers. That's going to be your job, right? And lateral defense slides. Make sure you can hold your position defensively too. Try to move those feet, right? But that's going to be your job. And we've seen time and time again, from Hall of Famers to role players, if you can, you know, basically be ready, be, you know, in position to shoot and get one of those kick out passes from LeBron, the drive and kick passes, and you can knock that shot down, mm-hmm. he will feed you over and over and over and over again. And so for Dont Connect, this could be a great opportunity, right? A real simple job to just be one of these guys who doesn't have to do a lot and can just be a nice fitting role player for LeBron. And I think the Lakers are right to be really excited about that pick. And I, like most people, I had him going in the lottery. Like, I thought he was going to go kind of late in that lottery zone, and he didn't.
Yeah, and again, speaking to the defensive side of things, that lateral mobility, there's any shooter who has success fitting in team defense, it's, again, his coach, J.J. Redick. So, Ben, I want to ask you this. This was obviously the first time that the NBA was split into multiple days. Again, another two-part question here for you, Ben. One, what did you think of this idea coming into the draft? And then what have you been hearing as far as like how well it was received or like the perceived success of the two-day event?
Well, the biggest thing was the scheduling, right? It's weird to have the draft on a Wednesday rather than a Thursday. So everybody was like kind of struggling to wrap their minds around. And it did feel like a quick turnaround from the NBA Finals. If the Finals had gone seven, they would have played that game on Sunday in Boston. And they would have had NBA Draft Media Day on Tuesday. That's ridiculous. Like, they need to find a way to put some real time in there so we could put some shine on these high school and college prospects. You know, you're so caught up in the end of the season, and then, you know, we don't really get a chance to really build up the excitement for the draft as much as we typically would. Now, this was a tough draft to do that because the headlining players just really weren't there. But in the future, I think it would be way better to do a Thursday-Friday draft as opposed to the Wednesday-Thursday draft. Now, they also got screwed because of the presidential debate. And that was like a super early presidential debate on the calendar, which normally wouldn't happen. And obviously, that can only happen every 4 years. But that's why they
can't let them miss their bedtimes. You know, they got to get to bed, you know.
Well, yeah. And like, I mean, but doing it at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, like, that's just rough. Right. And so that's just a weird look. And that was one where they just really couldn't control. By the time they had decided to make it 2 days, you know, the schedule hadn't been set for the debate. So they just kind of, you know, got blindsided there. I had two issues with the format. First, they invited too many players to the green room for day one. So multiple players left Barclays Center without getting picked after sitting on the floor in the green room for 3.5 hours watching the performance, right? So you get all dressed up for prom. You take the team photos with all these other prospects. you know, you've got your girlfriend or your wife or your parents, whoever it might be. And, you know, I was walking out of the building immediately after one of the players who didn't get selected in the first round, who had a green room invite. It was a tough scene, man. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. I mean, that's just unbelievably deflating and confusing. The NBA should not be putting players in that position because, I mean, imagine if you got a green room invite, even if you weren't top 75 on your own board, you're going to say yes because you're going to pray that they're right. They know something you don't, and you want to go have the great time. And you're not thinking about the downside of like, oh no, what if I don't get picked? This is going to be embarrassing, right? And I think it was important to note the guys who got green room invites on day one did not come back for day two to take the green room invites. They just said, screw it. And they went somewhere else to watch the draft. And so, come on, like the NBA, if you're trying to welcome these guys in, celebrate these players, let's make sure that doesn't happen. The easiest way to do it is to cut down. Instead of inviting 25 guys for a 30-player first round, invite somewhere in that 15 to 18 range, and you'll probably be safe, and you could probably avoid those worst-case scenarios. My second issue was the second round was designed for ESPN and television. It was not designed for the players, and it really wasn't designed, in my opinion, in the best interest of the NBA because they did this thing in an ESPN studio. That's where they had the show, but they actually had the second-round prospects in the media a floor above the ESPN studio show at this random like warehouse down by the Brooklyn Bridge. So there's these beautiful views, like great views, but these kids are just like sitting in an empty warehouse waiting to hear if their name's going to be called. And I'm sure you noticed this. They didn't even call every single name by Mark Tatum. Like they had the ESPN broadcasters were announcing some of the names. And so these guys were like sitting there with their parents, again, waiting to hear their name called. And it's not even the deputy commissioner who's doing it. They don't get to shake his hand. There's no like interaction. There's no big celebration moment. I think that, yes, it was probably more convenient and more cost effective for ESPN to hold the second round this way. But I think that they need to make it more player centric. They need to get, you know, they need to set it up in such a way that more of the players want to be there for the second round so that the environment is a little bit more celebratory for the players. I don't know if you can find some diehard fans to sit in the studio to kind of cheer when people get picked. But certainly, if you get drafted in the NBA, you should get a handshake moment with the deputy commissioner at minimum. And these guys didn't get that. And so I kind of felt bad for them. I know the teams were excited about how the format went because they had more time to think about who their second round picks were going to be. There was more time to execute trades. They had more time to line up guys for their summer league rosters and hand out those kinds of contracts. And having it split over 2 days, it just didn't run into like 2 a.m. You know, it wasn't like a 14-hour day for everybody. It was much more manageable. Right. So those are positives. But I thought there was some real negatives from the player side. And to me, of all the NBA events, the one that should be player-focused is the draft.
And I think that's fair. So do you think that this is something that might be here to stay, like just best estimate or best guess?
Oh, yeah. I think they're going to go with this two-day format because, one, it doubles the amount of TV inventory, right? Like, you got two shows instead of one, and you're going to have way more people theoretically watching if you could put the second round in primetime as opposed to having that run for like a five-hour show like it used to in the past and then just nobody's paying attention, right? So I think for sure the two-day format would be here to stay. I'm not reporting that, but I would be stunned if they went back the other direction. I think it's more likely that they'll use this first go-round as a kind of a brainstorming session, sort of like they did with the in-season tournament, and ask everybody, hey, what worked, what didn't, what could we tweak? And I think we're going to see a better version of what I've been describing by the time we get to next year's draft.
Which is probably, you know, if you're going to test drive anything for a draft, like, again, love the draft, right? But this might have been the draft class to do it. That way you get it right for Cooper and Ace next year, right?
100%. I totally agree.
Last question I have for you, Ben. It wouldn't be a draft show if we didn't talk about Bronny James, right? We try to keep that to a minimum here at No Ceilings because there's a lot of other players that we could talk about. He was obviously selected by the Los Angeles Lakers here with the 55th pick and will now join his father as the first ever father-son duo in the NBA. Do you think that this nepotism debate, you know, there's a lot of downtime right now, but do you think that we'll forget all about this whenever we watch them step onto the court for the first time ever? Do you think that that goes away, or do you think that they're just going to be some kind of Klingons here with the thought of it?
Well, look, I mean, obviously LeBron and Bronny together, that's a big target for people who don't, you know, either don't like LeBron, don't like the idea of, you know, his son getting drafted the same team, or, you know, just don't like the Lakers. So obviously they're going to get criticism on this one no matter what. I think it will age very well. I think it's going to be a cool moment when they finally fulfill this dream. LeBron's had this dream for more than a decade. And when they're actually on the court together, maybe they're passing to each other. Bronny throws a LeBron a lob, maybe the other way around. Maybe LeBron hits his son with a kick-out pass. He drains the three. It's going to be cool. Now, is it going to be as cool as Ken Griffey Jr. and Ken Griffey Sr., who are both amazing baseball players, hitting home runs back-to-back? Probably not, you know? And you know, you can't control these things. When Bronny was a freshman in high school, I think a lot of us expected him to be a pretty big-time prospect. He just never really hit that huge growth spurt. And then obviously he had the very scary health incident, you know, last summer. So it's great to even see that he just got cleared by the NBA doctors. I mean, that's never a guarantee in a situation like that. And so for him to have that moment, I'm happy for him because, like, you know, it was scary last summer. There's no question. In terms of the nepotism part of it, I would just point out the owner of the Lakers, Jeannie Buss, her dad was the owner of the Lakers. Her brother was the owner of the Lakers, right? They refer to Magic Johnson, Jeannie does, as her brother. And he's had all these different jobs with the Lakers, GM, coach, player over the years, right? You know, who is Jeannie Buss's big advisor? Well, it's Linda Rambis. Who's that? Well, it's the wife of one of Magic's former teammates, right? Who's Jeannie Buss's, you know, former significant other? Phil Jackson, happened to be coach of the Lakers. Who's the GM? Rob Pelinka. Well, he happened to be the agent for Kobe Bryant, right? Kobe Bryant, who is that? Well, he gets talked about as being a son of Jerry West, the guy who drafted him, right? And obviously the Lakers have done an amazing job of paying tribute to Kobe and even Kobe's daughter as well, Gianna, after their tragic death. You get my point here. This is a quote-unquote family organization. If there was ever an organization that was not going to care about nepotism, or not going to care about, oh, you guys just doing stuff with your friends, or, you know, it's all just connections, it's obviously going to be the Lakers. So, yeah, if LeBron's kid comes along and he's a reasonable prospect and he goes to USC, he's a McDonald's High School of American before the health scare, of course the Lakers are going to draft him. Nobody should be surprised by this. And I think there was a comment recently that Rob Pelinka said, you know, this is like the Lakers are where history is made. This was one of the biggest stories of the draft week. That's what the Lakers are about. And, you know, it used to be in the NBA, if you were a team, you would either sell wins or you would sell hope. That has changed here recently. You could sell wins, you could sell hope, you can also sell clicks and content, you know? And I think if you're the Lakers and you're stuck a little bit outside of that championship window, it's going to be really hard to make a deep playoff push with LeBron when he's 40 years old. That's kind of unrealistic. You look at all the older millennial players who are superstars this year, none of them made them deep in the playoffs at all. The last old guy standing was Al Horford, you know, and he's not exactly carrying the Celtics offensively, right? But like Steph was out, LeBron was out, Kawhi was out, Paul George was out, Harden was out, you know, Kevin Durant was out, Chris Paul was out. The list goes on and on, right? So you want to be relevant. If you can't win, you want to generate clicks. You want to be talked about. You want to be Showtime, right? And the Lakers are very, very good at keeping themselves in the conversation. And this is just one more move that goes along with that.
That was a beautiful breakdown of the, forgive my pun, actually, you can allow it if you want to, but the Lakers genealogy that you just went through right there. I thought that was fantastic. Very nice.
Wordplay.
Ba-doops. Yeah, I'm a dad. The dad jokes are strong. Ben, I just want to thank you, man, so much for your time. It was awesome to get to link back up with you and get your thoughts and opinions of the draft and some of the big stories that have come out of it. Before we get you out of here, could you please just take a moment and let the folks who are watching and listening know where they can find you and your work and maybe some things that you have going on?
Yeah, WashingtonPost.com/sports. I'll be at the USA basketball camp coming up in Las Vegas next week. Obviously, Summer League, you know, coming up after that, and then the Paris Olympics. So it's going to be a busy summer there. We're going to have all sorts of Olympic coverage at the Washington Post. And my podcast is The Greatest of All Talk. You can listen to, there, greatestofalltalk.com, to subscribe. And, you know, Instagram at Ben.Golliver, Twitter at Ben Golliver, for kind of the live updates and behind-the-scenes stuff here as we go forward into a very, very busy NBA summer. And need I forget, we got free agency coming even before 4th of July. And you know, I'm sure a bunch of trades and a bunch of signings here over the next few days. So it's going to be great.
Yeah. And again, Ben, thank you so much for your time. For everybody watching and listening, please go and follow Ben and all the great stuff that he's got going on. Just be sure to like, share, subscribe, rate, and review to No Ceilings. Go to NoCeilingsNBA.com. We have merch there that Corey just put out. So please go there and you can find the new things that we have going on. And just again, anywhere you got your podcast, No Ceilings NBA. But for my guest here, Ben, for myself, and for the fine folks at No Ceilings, we just want to wish you all a good rest of your day. Much love, y'all.